So for the last 2 weeks, we have looked at Mark 11 through 12, in which Jesus condemns the temple and its leadership and points forward to a time of change and of something better yet to come. And we've spent time talking about this. We used the fig tree imagery, the cleansing of the temple, and what we talked about is how that's all pointing towards the fact that he disrupted the sacrificial and the ceremonial systems for a reason. And they didn't understand it yet, and it's one of those hindsight 2020 things. They'd understand it later looking back. What he was pointing to is that the time of these things is done. Something better is coming. And today, in chapter 13, as he leaves the temple and then sits down on the Mount of Olives with some of his disciples, he's going to talk about the coming destruction of the temple, but he's also going to talk about the future and his return. I'm going to do my best to help us see the main point of what's going on and what I believe to be the best way to understand these complicated verses. But I am by no means guaranteeing that I'm going to answer every question that you have. I'm also by no means guaranteeing I'm going to help you discover every nuance and every layer of what's going on. I'll talk about that as we go. I'm also not guaranteeing that my position is indefensible and there's no weaknesses in my position. I'm also not guaranteeing you're going to agree with everything. This is a kind of end times text. We'll talk fancy words, eschatology, and there is so much debate over these texts. I'm going to point us to key indicators in the text that I believe point towards a certain way of understanding how the chapter is laid out. And if you have questions of things that I don't get to, because we're going to be covering the whole chapter 13, and I'm not going to have time to dig deeply into every verse. So if there are things I don't cover today, then feel free to ask me to clarify or add more or whatever in the Q&A for next week, or just talk to me personally. But either way, just want to give fair warning for that. And I want to preface this by saying that this chapter is complicated for many reasons. One of the primary reasons, the first primary reason that Jesus talks about the destruction of the temple and his return, or the end of days, depending on what verse you're looking at, in a way that is confusing to determine when he is talking about which thing. The second complication is that he blends prophecy with apocalyptic language, so you have to work through the layers of imagery to understand what he is saying. And apocalyptic language, or apocalyptic writing, by the way, is writing that uses vivid and dramatic images and metaphors to describe earthly events in a way that breaks us out of our limited human perspective on those events. So that's a formal definition. Basically, what apocalyptic literature is you see this in the prophets, you see it in Revelation, it was a common genre of the time, and it uses very dramatic imagery, very dramatic metaphors to speak about normal earthly events in a way that helps us to break out of the mundane way of thinking about it and help us to see or get a glimpse of the supernatural truths that are going on behind it. A great example for this, by the way, if you want to see how this can be used for something that's actually, it's like a big deal, but it's a fairly normal event, is if you turn, you can even look here while I continue talking, but Psalm 18, specifically in verses 7 through 19. Psalm 18 is introduced with a historical marker that this is written by David after he had been delivered from his enemies, delivered from Saul in the caves. And you can actually go, I think it's in 1 Samuel, it's 1 or 2 Samuel, you can go and read the historical account of when that happened. And it's interesting to read that and then go read in that and then read immediately Psalm 18, 7 through 19, and you're like, well, none of that happened. Because in Psalm 18, 7 through 19, there's language like the mountains are being flattened, God's like fire breathing, and like all this stuff is like crazy things are happening. And then you go to the passage of what actually happened, and you're like, David was rescued from Saul when he was in a cave. And that's what happened. But what's going on is David is describing what he felt like. He's describing the spiritual truths of what's happening, the fight between darkness and light. And he's trying to break you out of the natural human way of thinking about events and thinking from more of a spiritual, more of a supernatural perspective. And that's not to say that the events themselves didn't happen, but it's just a different way of thinking about the events. So I want to say that as part of the introduction to what we'll be talking about, So that's the second complication, is that there is apocalyptic language in this chapter, and also in the parallel passages in the other Gospels, by the way, because Luke and Matthew both share much content with this chapter. This chapter also is absolutely loaded with Old Testament allusions, quotes, and imagery, and you know that I'm an Old Testament geek, so sorry, you're going to get a lot of Old Testament today, again, and I don't apologize for that. But this chapter specifically is incredibly loaded with Old Testament, so much so that I will not have time to cover nearly everything at all. So our interpretation will be greatly lacking if we do not know the Old Testament well. In fact, this is one of, if not the primary reasons that Caleb and I have not preached through Revelation from the pulpit. Because we, as your pastors, feel that we need to have worked through some of the key Old Testament books at least first from the pulpit before we are willing to work through Revelation from the pulpit. I know it's not abnormal. I know it's like the viral thing to be preaching through Revelation pretty often from the pulpit. But Caleb and I, in order to do it justice, feel like we need to be working through as a church some of the Old Testament and some of the background stuff behind it before we're comfortable doing that from the pulpit. Not that we don't talk about it, like we've discussed it in Sunday school and other contexts, but that's just our stance on preaching Revelation. So with all those caveats and warnings out of the way, let's get started with Mark. Mark chapter 13. And we'll start with verses 1 through 2. So Mark 13, 1 through 2. As he came out of the temple, one of the disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, what wonderful stones and what wonderful buildings." And Jesus said to him, "Do you see these great buildings? There will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." And we talked about this last week, but I want to remind us by way of review that what he is saying here is, if you look back in 12 and look to 12 verses 10 through 11, and this is at the end of the parable of the tenant, he's saying, "Have you not read the scripture? The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. This is the Lord's doing. It is marvelous in his eyes." And we talked about last week how that is a way of saying that Jesus is the cornerstone and he is the beginning of the rebuilding of the temple into something even greater. And then on his way out of the temple, the disciples who heard that look at the stones of the temple and say, "Oh, these are marvelous stones." And he's like, "Guys, no, like, I mean, yes, they are. It actually, the temple should have been one of the wonders of the ancient world. Like, it was amazing." But his reaction is, you missed the whole point. This temple is doomed. And a greater temple is being built in me. And you're marveling at these stones when you should have been marveling at the cornerstone of what is to come. So I just want to bring that back up by way of review, because again, we did talk about that a little bit last week. But continuing in verse 3 here, I'm just going to read verses 3 and 4. "And he sat on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple. Peter and James and John and Andrew asked him privately, 'Tell us when these things will be, and what will be the sign when all these things are about to be accomplished?'" The immediate context for this question is the question of Jesus' prediction of the destruction of the temple. Because if you just look at the verses immediately prior, they're asking, they're saying, "See these marvelous stones?" He's like, "Well, do you see these great buildings?" And buildings, by the way, when you read that, you have to think about the temple complex. Because it's easy for us to be like, "Oh, the temple, it's one building." When actually it was like a very large complex. Again, like I mentioned before, it was very grand. Honestly, should have been one of the wonders of the world. But that's what he's referring to, is all those buildings. So then they ask, "Tell us, when will these things be?" Referring to what he just said. But I also think that it is very likely that they also not only are asking about the destruction of the temple, but when you think about the disciples' view of the future and what they're anticipating, and especially how many times, like, they, now that they've mostly kind of figured out that he's the Messiah, and they're asking basically, "Well, what's our seat of power going to be, like, when the kingdom comes?" Like, they're anticipating the kingdom coming in their lifetime, and they're having, like, seats of power with it. So I think it's very valid to read this question about the destruction of the temple, to read additional layers into it of, like, okay, well, when's the kingdom coming, and where are we going to be seated with it, and when are you coming in power, and when is all this going to happen? So there's a surface level question about the temple, but I think there's also deeper layers that the disciples are also asking about as well. And we know this even from, you look at Acts 1:6, right before he ascends, and they're even there still asking about, well, when's the kingdom going to come? Because they're still thinking, like, okay, this is coming now. And you can read that back into this question here. And therefore, because of all that, Jesus including in his response, talking about his return and the end of days, should not surprise us. Because he's answering the surface level question, but also asking the questions behind it. He's also answering the questions behind it as well. So I believe the best way to understand how he does this throughout the chapter is through what's called step parallelism. If you've never heard of it, that's fine. So this is a typical method of argument of the time, and it was used in a lot of just how people wrote, how they spoke even. Like, we in the Western culture have more of a linear way of speaking, where we start at the beginning of a story or an argument, and we just continue to the end. That's just typically of how Western culture thinks and talks. That's not true even today of other cultures, and it's also not true of the ancient Near Eastern culture that Jesus was a part of. And a lot of how they spoke and thought and argued and wrote had more of a parallelism, more of what we call talk chiasms a lot, where it works towards the middle and then works back out, and there's something really important in the middle, and it seems to kind of circle around it. There's also what's called step parallelism, which if you imagine two stairways. So you have two stairways going down right by each other. On the top stair, you're going to have something that sounds similar on each stairway. And then on the next stair down, you're going to have something else that sounds similar on each stairway, and you keep stepping down. And you think about that of writing, you're like, okay, say you have three verses, they each say something different, and then the next three verses each say something different. And you're like, well, wait, verse 4 sounds like verse 1, and verse 2 sounds like verse 5, and verse 3 sounds like verse 6. That's because they're doing step parallelism. They're matching each other on the way down. So that's step parallelism, and that's what I believe is going on here. And it should not surprise us that he does this, because again, it's a pretty typical argument. And then especially when you use apocalyptic language, apocalyptic writings tended to have fairly advanced structures of arguments and how they use their imagery and how they use the images. So I didn't have a PowerPoint for this, but if you want to write it down either in your notes or maybe even note this in your Bible, but what I'm going to broadly present here, and I will point out caveats and exceptions to this and stuff as we go, but what I'm going to broadly present this as is that the first step is verses 5 through 23, because his answer starts in verse 5. So 5 through 23 starts his answer by talking about the destruction of the temple. And then the next step down is verses 24 to 27. And your Bible probably has these all divided in headers, so you could even just like title a header. Verses 24 to 27 talks about the coming of the Son of Man. So you have the destruction of the temple, and then the coming of the Son of Man. And then the next stair set is starting in 13:28 to 39, and it matches the first step of the other staircase by talking about a parable about the destruction of the temple. And then in 32 to 37, there's a parable about the coming of the Son of Man. So there's the destruction of the temple, the coming of the Son of Man, and then a parable about the destruction of the temple, and a parable about the coming of the Son of Man. So they match each other with the steps. And now that I've laid that all out for you and possibly confused everybody, I'm going to keep going, and we're going to talk about what that all means as we go here. So as we go through these sections, I'm going to point out features and key phrases that seem to point towards this outline. And then also what I will point out continually as we go is that this outline does not mean that the advice or principles from one section can't apply to the other section at all, or that there aren't other possible fulfillments that are at play with what's going on. And we talked about this a bit in Sunday school about the concept of fulfillment of prophecy and how there's so much already not yet. There's like, it's fulfilled in one way, and then it's fulfilled a greater way, and then it's fulfilled a greater way. So like, be open to those layers. And then the other reason is that, or the other reason that you should not just say that, like, well, this is in this one section, so it only ever applies to something in this historical event. It's like, well, God uses repetition and typology a lot. There's a reason why a lot of the stuff that happens in Jesus' life, a lot of stuff that happens even later in the Old Testament, sounds a lot like stuff that happens earlier in the Old Testament, because there's a lot of typology that happens. And what typology is a form of prophecy. And how it's a form of prophecy is that things that happen in the events of somebody's life somehow sound really similar to things that happen in the event of somebody else's life. That's kind of a fulfillment of that. One of the obvious ones from the story of Jesus that we talked about when we were back in chapter 1 is that in the temptation of Jesus, he's tempted in the wilderness for 40 days. Well, that sounds an awful lot like the Israel being in the wilderness for 40 years. And it's years, days, but we talked about that. And that's a form of typology. It's not a prophecy. When Israel was wandering for 40 years, there was no prophecy that you read, well, the Messiah will be in the wilderness for 40 days being tempted. There's not a prophecy that you'll read about that. But it's a type that he fulfills later. So that's an example of typology. But all that to say, I want to start working through the text here. So starting in verse 5. In the first few verses here, in verse 5 through 13, what I see this as doing is he's attempting to temper their enthusiasm for like the immediacy they feel of when these things are going to happen by warning them not to be drawn away by things that are not true indicators of that day. Because honestly, that's the temptation that has been present for all of Christian history from the time of Christ. Like literally even in the time of Christ, or like just after he died, you already had people saying, oh, it's the day, or oh, the tribulation is about to start, or like whatever, fill in the blank. Like you can literally point to that happening like very, very quickly after Jesus died. And it even is present in the epistles and how some of them are written and what they're talking about. And it continues all the way through today. So he's first trying to kind of temper their enthusiasm and saying, well, okay, I'm going to talk about some stuff that's not the indicator of the coming day. And the coming day, we have to remember, is we're in this section about temple destruction. So he's first kind of tempering their enthusiasm about like, well, the temple's going to be destroyed today. He's like, well, not quite. Let's talk about it. So in verse 6, he says, many will come in my name saying, I am he, and they will lead many astray. And then continuing on, and when you hear of wars and rumor of wars, do not be alarmed. This must take place, but the end is not yet. So again, he's talking about things that are not, like, they're signs, but they're not yet signs. So he warns first against false messiahs that will lead many astray. And we know from history that multiple false messiahs arose even within the next 20 years. And then the next thing he warns about is reading too much into wars, rumors of wars, the rise and fall of kingdoms, and earthquakes and famines. How many of you have, when a war starts in the Middle East or anywhere, heard all sorts of stuff and seen all sorts of stuff posted online about how we've now entered the tribulation or how this is a sign that the end is coming? Like, I've grown up hearing it my whole life, and those of you that are older and more mature than me have probably heard it even longer than that. It is not new, and what's a little frustrating is we're literally told right here that that's not the sign. But these things are ever-present things that are but the beginnings of earth pains, or birth pains. They are a normal part of the long process of labor and not the time to panic. And they are because they're part of being in a fallen world. There is fighting, there is brokenness, there is disaster, there is wars and rumors of wars and rise and fall of kingdoms because we live in a broken world that doesn't have our forever king yet, here, physically. And because of that, these things are just always present. These things have been present through all of history and have, despite the warnings here, caused many people to fear that or feel that they are living in the end times going all the way back to the time of the apostles. And then you also have the mention of earthquakes and famine. And this is pretty typical imagery, actually. If you go through the Old Testament, there's a lot of times where it talks about a coming war or the event of a war as a earthquake. And you read that and you're like, well, history doesn't show a major earthquake happened at that time. We are not allowing sometimes the language of the Bible to do the same thing that our language does today. Have you ever heard the phrase an earth-shaking event? Or an earth-shattering or a world-breaking? It's just a figure of speech. It's not a falsehood of the Bible to say that there's an earthquake or famine when there actually wasn't a major earthquake or famine. They're just doing the same exact thing that we do with our language, and sometimes we just don't allow it. It also, though, I think, is a little two-sided here. I think there's that aspect in that that is picking up on the Old Testament theme of using earthquake and famine language to just talk about war. But I also think it is poking at looking at natural disasters in the same way that we look at wars and rumors of war and overreading into it and saying, oh, now this is the time. It's like, guys, like there are always famines. There's pretty much always been earthquakes since the fall and tornadoes and hurricanes and all these things. And some are really bad. But that's not the indicator that you're supposed to be watching for. So I think there's two things in these verses here that we're not supposed to be overreading into, and those are wars and rumors of wars, rise and falls of kingdoms, but then also natural disasters as well. And don't hear me say any of that to say that that belittles the destruction and the hurt and the pain that's part of all those things. We are to feel the urgency of the pain that is brought by those things and help if we are able to help. So I don't want you to hear me saying that I'm like dismissing all those things. But then as you continue in 9, and I'm going to purposely skip 10 right here because 10 is something else, but 9 and then 11 through 13, he warns them to be on guard and be ready to endure as a faithful witness. And it talks about being brought to the synagogues and beaten there and brought before governors and kings and then facing betrayals from family. And what he's saying here is that you will be persecuted. And what's interesting, he starts with beatings of the synagogues. You will be persecuted by your own people. And then also by the leaders of the nations around you as well. And that's the mention of governors and kings and things like that. And in these times, they will be called to be a witness. And they will also face betrayals. He encourages them, though, that the Holy Spirit will give them the words to say in their hour of need. Which is interesting, because this is the same promise actually given to Moses, to Isaiah, to Jeremiah. This is actually a really big promise that we kind of miss because we're like, oh yeah, we have the Holy Spirit. And we forget that in the Old Testament, that was not the case. The Holy Spirit came as a temporal empowerment for certain tasks and duties and was at times promised. Like when Moses was like, well, I don't know what to say to Pharaoh and he's not going to believe me anyway. The Lord says, I will give you the words. And then that ends up being changed where Aaron ends up being his mouthpiece. But like the promise is still there. And what is fascinating here is basically Jesus is telling them, you will be like the prophets of the Old Testament. You will be filled with the Spirit and you will be given the words that you need in your hour of need. And if you want some great examples of that, by the way, go read the book of Acts because there's some really good examples there. He also tells them in verse 10 that the gospel will be proclaimed to all the nations first. The great irony of this is that if you understand this verse to fall in the section about the prediction of the fall of the temple and the destruction of the temple, is that the purpose of the temple is going to be accomplished despite the failure of the temple and its leadership. It is going to live to see accomplished what it failed to do. And why I say this is that we talked about this last week and the week before. Part of Jesus' judgment and cleansing of the temple was his judgment of how they were marginalizing and ignoring the Gentiles, despite the fact that his house was supposed to be a house of prayer for all nations. Israel was to be a holy priesthood to draw nations to God, and Solomon, in his temple dedication, prayed that it would be a place through which all people of earth would know the Lord. Solomon, in his dedication, said, if any foreigner or any outsider comes here and prays to you, please hear him so that your word will go out and there will be followers of you in all nations. That was built in to the purpose of the temple. When God called out his people and made the covenant with them and formed them into a people, he said, you are now a holy nation. You are a priesthood set aside for me. That meant that they were to be the light to all the nations. And that's why you have so much anger when Jesus is dealing with the leaders and their failure to do that. They're marginalizing, they're ignoring, and they're casting out of the Gentiles. And that's part of why he does what he does in the cleansing, and he has many words that he says to them about that too. But the temple, again, getting back to the irony of it, the temple that was supposed to be part of this call and this mission to the nations, the temple will live to see the gospel being proclaimed to all nations. And I, again, point you to the book of Acts. Because by the end of Acts, the gospel has been proclaimed to all known nations at the time. And the end of Acts is actually still a bit before the destruction of the temple. In 14 to 23, he then transitions to the sign that will be the day of destruction, and it will be time to flee. Starting in 14, he says, but when you see the abomination of desolation standing where he ought not to be, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. This abomination of desolation refers back to Daniel 9. And the prophecy that it is part of in Daniel 9 was fulfilled in 168 BC, when Antiochus IV brought his army into Israel, built an altar on God's altar, and sacrificed a pig on it. So on God's altar in the temple, he built a pagan altar and sacrificed pigs, which were unclean, to another god. That was the abomination of desolation. That was the fulfillment of Daniel 9. And why I say it's fulfillment of Daniel 9, if you go back and look at Daniel 9 and 10, it's very much talking of, like, you can trace historically all those prophecies. And it's, like, insanely detailed, too. So that was the abomination at that time. And that led to the Maccabean revolt. The disciples were to watch for a similar sign and a similar desecration. One thing I want to point out here before we keep going, though, is that the ESV translation of he here is a translation choice. And it is a little bit unhelpful, I would argue, to catch the flow of what's going on. It says, when you see the abomination of desolation standing where he ought not to, that he is added in. And I'm not slamming them for adding in he. Like, this is a very common thing that you have to do in Greek and Hebrew, because the Greek and Hebrew words have the article, or the pronoun, sorry, built in to the word. But the problem here is that this is simply a unclarified third-person verb. And what I mean by that is you can put he, she, or it here. And you have to choose. So the translators, the ESV, and they're not the only one, but also not every translation does this. If you look at a bunch of different translations, you're going to see either he or it. And that translation choice is based on what you feel like is happening here. And I would argue that it's best understood as it. The abomination of desolation is a thing that will happen. A common option for what this abomination would be, referring in the time of the destruction of the temple, is the sacrifices that the Roman soldiers made to their standards, which we look at that and we're like, well, that's just a standard. Like, the standards bore the image of Caesar, who was understood to be a god. So you get there, and it's blatantly opposing to the place of God's worship to bring another banner who bears another god in there. So they made up offerings to their standards at the eastern gate of the temple when the temple was destroyed. A problem with this view, though, is that this came at the end of the Jewish revolt of 66 to 70 and would have been too late to flee. So if the instruction here is, see this abomination, it's time to flee, if that sign is the thing that comes at the very end of the revolt, it's too late at that point to flee. So there are a lot of commentators that aren't super big fans of that option. It is an option, though. So I'm not going to sit here dogmatically and say that what I'm going to present is definitely the answer. It's just there are arguments against it. A better option is probably the desecration of the temple by zealots in AD 67 to 68, near the beginning of the revolt. These zealots were people who began, basically the Jewish revolt was led by and prompted by the zealots, and they killed some of the priests and leaders in the temple. They shed blood in the temple and appointed their own completely unqualified high priest. Like, they literally had to tell this guy what to do because he had no idea what to do as a priest. And the true high priest, Ananus, who they also killed later, expressed extreme grief and is quoted as saying he had grieved the day that he had seen the house of God full of so many abominations. There is likely also a future aspect to these verses, since God often uses historical typology. And why I'm saying this is, you think about the abomination of desolation, and a lot of people we have in our minds, like, well, there's abomination of desolation happening later at the end of days. I'm not saying there's not. But I'm saying what Jesus was talking about here was probably the destruction of the temple, but that God often uses typology. Now, I would not be surprised if there's some sort of abomination later at the end of time as well, just like there was in 168. Like, I think there's a lot of repetition that happens. And the reason that I lean towards this view, the 67-68 abomination by the zealots, is that this fits the description. It also allows time to flee. It could have been understood by the original readers. They would have known this was an abomination. In fact, the high priest at the time literally said this is an abomination. And then it also would have happened during that generation, which is something we'll talk about later in verse 30. And then as we continue here, starting in 14, looking at 14 through 18, when he says, let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, let the one who's on the housetop not go down, not enter the house, not take it down. There's this urgent fleeing here. This message to urgently flee from God's judgment is not cowardice, but a repeated theme throughout the Old Testament for those who listen to God to save themselves from his judgment so that something new can start. This theme is seen in the instructions for Noah and his family to build an ark and save themselves and anybody who would listen despite the fact that nobody did listen. And then it is also seen, and often with specific directions to go to the mountains, in the story of Lot, and also in warnings that Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel give. So it's easy to brush by this and be like, well, you're supposed to flee when the things get tough. And it's like, well, that's just cowardice. You're fleeing. And it's like, no, this is actually judgment coming from God that he forewarned his people and gave them the advice to flee when they see the judgment coming. And this is a common theme throughout the Old Testament. And as we look next to verses 19 through 20, in 19 to 20, what we read is, "For in those days there will be such tribulation as has not been from the beginning of the creation that God created until now and never will be. And if the Lord had not cut short the days, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect whom he chooses, he shortened the days." This is one of the sections in this first section, which is talking about the destruction of the temple, that we're like, we read that word and you're like, well, at face value, that's obviously talking about the end of the world. Except for the fact that this is actually also fairly common language for just talking about times of extreme judgment and God's wrath. And also talking about how he never violates his covenant by destroying his people completely. You can go all the way back to his discussion with Moses about wanting to destroy all the people, but saving some so that he could continue them. There's the same language that happens, again, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, like these prophets are some of the major prophets from the Old Testament and quoted so much in the New Testament for a reason. There's so much imagery that's being pulled from them. This also greatest judgment ever language was used in the Exodus. There's talking about it in Joel when he's talking about the coming judgment of Judah for their betrayal and their idolatry. This is language that can but does not necessarily have to refer to the end of days. And why I bring all that up is because it does seem odd for this to be in a section that seems to be talking about the destruction of the temple. But if you think about how the destruction of the temple and how the siege and the destruction of the city would seem, it would feel like the end of days. It would feel like this something of this magnitude is happening, nothing greater will ever be, and that the Lord had to cut short the days for the sake of his people. Like, that's how it's going to feel. And sometimes we try to read the stuff in the Bible at too much of face value and don't allow it to be saying the layers of just the emotional layer and the imagery layer of what it's saying. I also would argue, though, that here, just like in other verses and just like with the abomination of desolation, you can apply the same language certainly to the end of days as well. I just would argue in this context, it seems to be in the context talking about the coming destruction of the temple. And then as we continue in 21 to 23, he again warns against listening to false messiahs and false prophets who will even perform signs and wonders, but instead to remember his warning. And a historical anecdote here that talks about this as it relates to the fall of the temple is that during the siege of Jerusalem, the city's leaders paid false prophets to give false hope to reduce desertions. And those who listened to the false prophets and the false messiahs instead of listening to the warning that Jesus had given them were destroyed. So that ends the first step, if you will, talking about the fall of the destruction of the temple. And then the next step starts in 24 and talks about the coming of the Son of Man. I'll just read this because it's just three quick verses, or four, sorry. "But in those days, after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will be falling from heaven, and the sun and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. And when they see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory, and then he will send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven." In the next four verses, I believe we have a shift to the next step down in this parallelism, and the topic has shifted to the coming of the Son of Man. There are three indicators of this. First, the first section, 5 through 23, is bracketed by a warning to watch or be on guard. If you look on verse 5, "Jesus began to say to them, 'See that no one leads you astray. Many will come in my name, saying, I am he, and they will lead you astray.'" "And Jesus began to say to them, 'See that no one leads you astray.'" The reason I missed that is that this is another thing, unfortunately, that the ESV obscures a little bit. The word "see" there is the word for watch, be on guard. It's just translated as "see" in this ESV translation, and probably others as well. But it's actually the same word, the same idea that's at the end of 23 where it says, "but be on guard." The same words, and those words bracket this section. So there seems to be a distinct bracketing, a bookending that's happening in this section here. And then also the second indicator is that the phrase, but after the tribulation, which starts 24, but in those days after that tribulation. So this seems to be a this, then that type of order that's happening here. So 5 to 23 is talking about something, and then 24 to 27 is talking about the next thing. So that seems to indicate that these events come after the events of the previous verses. And then also what's interesting to note here is that the verses in 24 to 27 shift the pronouns from second person to third person. And what I mean by that is that in 5 to 23, it's all you. And then later it'll be this generation on the parallel step. But in these verses, it's they, the people. It seems to be no longer referring to something that'll happen in the time period of those he's talking to, but something that'll happen in a time period to come when it's no longer you, but them later. So there's a shift here in the pronouns that even tips us off to there's a shift here in his focus. In describing the return of the Son of Man, Jesus uses the imagery of the sun and moon being darkened and the stars falling down and the powers in heaven being shaken. This is also Old Testament imagery that is used many times to talk about times of great judgment, especially the end of powerful kingdoms. So it is entirely appropriate, if we're talking about the end of days, to use this imagery that's used with end of kingdoms to talk about the end of the kingdom of man and the final fulfillment and ushering in fully of God's kingdom and the time of final judgment. We also read that people will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. This image is taken from Daniel 7, where the Son of Man is brought to the Ancient of Days and given authority, glory, and power. And we read in those verses also that all nations and people will worship him, and his kingdom will never be destroyed. How I see this allusion here, working together with the verses in Daniel 7, is through the thread of what Jesus says at the Great Commission in Matthew 28. There, after trampling the powers of darkness through his death and his resurrection, he tells the disciples that all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to him. Wait, what did we just read in Daniel 7? All authority and power and glory was given to the Son of Man, and his kingdom was going to be a kingdom that would never end and include people from all nations. And Jesus says, all authority and power is given to me, now go preach to all nations. Those seem to be very connected ideas. So he tells them that all authority has been given to him. They are to go and make disciples of all nations, encouraging them that he will be with them until the end. Through his death and resurrection, Jesus, the Son of Man, is given authority, glory, and power, and control, and the control that the forces of darkness had over the nations is broken for his kingdom to spread and conquer all, saving hearts everywhere. And we talked about this in Sunday school a little bit as well, so I'm going to shorten it for the sake of time. But we have to remember that the promise to Abraham that his offspring and his descendants, one of his descendants, would be a blessing to all nations came right after the division of the nations in Genesis 11, where the nations turned away from God, built the Tower of Babel, and then he scattered them, broke them into different groups of different languages. And then the very next chapter, God calls out Abram to himself and says, out of you, I will make a nation, and your offspring will be a blessing to all the nations. There's a reversal of Babel that's happening here. And when he gets all power and authority, then what this is saying is that the power of Babel, the division of the peoples, the power that the dark forces have over all the nations that have been blinding them, as we've read about the language of the Old Testament, that's broken. And God's kingdom is being ushered in through the Great Commission. And the light is breaking into the darkness. When he returns, we read, he will gather his elect, or his people, which he has been redefining, by the way, as he's been doing his ministry. He's been redefining this and helping people to see that his people includes people of any nation who follow and obey him. He will gather them from the ends of the earth, fulfilling the prophecies of the greater Exodus and the gathering in of all peoples that we have talked about many times, and is a common theme in the Old Testament, starting, just like I said, all the way back to Abraham. He then closes in the next few verses with two parables, and the two parables start in 28. The first one is a parable about the destruction of the temple, and then the next one is a parable about the coming of the Son of Man. Seeing these parables as being about two separate things also helps us to understand why in the first one he says you can know when the time is near, and then like two verses later in the next one he says you cannot know when the time is near. If you read them as both about the same thing, that's really confusing. But if you allow and apply the step parallelism, it clears that up. So first in 28 to 31, From the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see these things taking place, you know that he is near, at the very gates. Truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. Just as he used the fig tree to picture the failure of the religious leaders and the destruction of the temple, so he here again recycles the fig tree imagery again. This time, though, he uses the imagery of the appearance of leaves signaling the approach of summer. Just as this is an obvious sign, so the abomination of desolation mentioned before will be an obvious sign to show that it, the destruction of the temple, is at the very gates. In 29, one thing to point out here, in 29, the ESV and other translations, by the way, as an aside here, I'm not purposely knocking on the ESV just for the sake of knocking on the ESV. I do this because it's the Pew Bible. It's what a lot of us probably have in front of us, and I just like to point things out that probably a lot of us are seeing. It is not the only translation that does this. But in 29, the ESV and other translations, but not all, have he is near. So if you read in 29, it says, so also when you see these things taking place, know that he is near. Some translations even actually add in when his return is near. The word return is not in there. In fact, he is not in there. It's again just a third person verb. So you have to supply he, she, or it. And again, what you do with that shows your translation choice. I would argue that it seems to fit better here, especially when you see in the step parallelism that this section is referring to the temple and its destruction. So it's not he is near, but it, the time, is near. And this view is also supported in these verses by the repetition of these things. Because if you caught that here, in verse 30, it says, truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. The original question that started all this, if you go back to 4, tell us when these things will be. There's a purposeful connection there about this is answering the surface level layer of your question. So the mention of these things ties this to the original temple destruction question. And it also specifies that this generation will not pass away. Throughout the Bible, a generation usually refers to 30 to 40 years, and the temple was destroyed right around 40 years after Jesus said this. So that would fulfill his words, this generation will not pass away, it'd be the very end of this generation. The Jewish leaders, by the way, if we think back to chapter 8, the Jewish leaders demanded a sign from heaven to test him. So it's kind of interesting here that he says, heaven and earth will not pass away, but my words, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. That phrase is used of Yahweh in the Old Testament, used of God the Father, to say that he is more permanent than heaven and earth. Jesus here is saying that about himself, which is really ironic because the leaders have been like, well, you need to give us a sign from heaven. He's like, I am from heaven, and the sign is that your temple is going to be destroyed before this generation is done. It's not the sign they wanted, I don't think, but it's the sign they got. And then as we continue to the second parable in 32 to 37, but concerning that day or that hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. Be on guard, keep awake, for you do not know when the time will come. It is like a man going on a journey when he leaves home and puts his servants in charge, each with his work, and commands the doorkeeper to stay awake. Therefore, stay awake, for you do not know when the master of the house, and my Bible is refusing to flip only one page here, just a second. There we go. You do not know when the master of the house will come in the evening or at midnight or when the rooster crows or in the morning, lest he come suddenly and find you asleep. And what I say to you all, stay awake. So switching back to his return, because again, this is the second step in the step parallelism. He says, but concerning that day or that hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven or the Son, but only the Father. There will be no sure sign before the Son returns. And if you follow the step parallelism and apply it, that puts the biggest hole in any argument you've ever heard about, well, we know when the Son is going to come, or on this day the Son of Man will come. If you apply this here and just read him directly saying, no man will know the hour, there is no sure sign to watch for. He's going to come. Some phrases say it's like lightning in the night. By that I mean it's just this bright sudden thing that just happens. There will be no sure sign before he returns, so we are to be on guard and keep awake. Do what he commanded until he returns. He says it is like a master who has left his house on a journey and puts his servants in charge until he returns. They don't know when he's coming back, but they're supposed to be about the work that he gave them until he does. Because he does not want to find them asleep, or another way of saying that is neglecting their duties when he returns. It is interesting to note, by the way, that he says his return may be in the evening or at midnight or when the rooster crows or in the morning, as these times are very significant to the rest of Mark. Specifically the rooster crowing, that bring anything to mind? But these four time markers here actually correspond with Passover, the Garden of Gethsemane, Peter's denial, and then Jesus taken in the morning before Pilate. And it shows that when I said earlier that you shouldn't be oversimplistic in how you take even the step parallelism I'm presenting and saying, well, this only applies to this and this only applies to this, I would say there's an aspect of this that even applies to how the events of Jesus' life play out in the next few chapters. In fact, this whole chapter, whether it's talking about the destruction of the temple or talking about the return of the Son of Man, this whole chapter is filled with connections to the words and events of the Passion Week. One of the commentators that I was reading through made a chart, and he had like 30 connection points between the specific words and phrases that Jesus says in this chapter and specific words and phrases that happen in the life of Jesus that's fulfilled in the next few days of the Passion Week here. Which, you think about the Passion Week, the death and the resurrection of Christ, is there an event that might be appropriate to talk about with apocalyptic language and with magnitude and with saying it's like the end of things? And yeah, like the language of this chapter would apply really well also to the layer and the event of Jesus' ministry. He was beaten in the synagogue. He was denied and betrayed by friends. The sun was darkened at his death. Jesus had to tell his disciples to watch and pray and not sleep in the garden. And those are just a few of like the 30 connection points. Because of these connections and because of the complications of this chapter, I suggest that you use the outline that I gave you as simply a guide, but also be open to seeing that other connections, layers, and already not yet fulfillments are there. So I'm sorry that's less than helpful, but that's just how prophecy and apocalyptic language and all this already not yet stuff works. There's a layer there that we probably should see as the overarching layer, but there's fulfillments, some of which we may even miss, and then we only get as we dig deeper and deeper. For today, however you understand the specifics of this chapter, the temple was destroyed just as he said, and just like all the other prophecies that he fulfilled. He was correct. Heaven and earth will pass away, but his words will not pass away. He is trustworthy and true. He told us the end of the story. We may not ever fully understand until it happens how or when it will happen, but we do know what he has told us to do while we wait. Be on guard and stay awake until he returns. We have his great commission, and we have the commands and exhortations that he gave us. He doesn't ask us that we figure everything out about the end of days, just that we trust that his word is true and that we live for him while we wait. We are the servants in the parable that are put in charge of tasks that he's given us until he returns, until he brings us home. Do you want to live like somebody living for the end of days? Then I'll tell you to look at Micah 6:8. He has told you, O man, what is good and what the Lord requires of you. Do justice. Love mercy. And that word mercy is a packed word. It means mercy, kindness, faithfulness, goodness. Love those things and walk humbly with your God. When he returns, he is not going to grade your end times chart. He is going to ask, did you love God and did you love others? Let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you for this text. It is complicated, and I'm sure I missed things. It is a reminder, though, that your words are true. The prophecies about you have been and will be fulfilled. Your word is trustworthy and true, and you are faithful. You are the one that is completely worthy of us giving every second of our day to. And I pray that we will be as the servants that you have given tasks to, that we will be found faithful and watching. I pray all this in your name. Amen.